I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Florida U.S. Senator Marco Rubio has been working on a bipartisan immigration reform bill, but are his efforts hurting his conservative credentials? Also, while Governor Rick Scott's approval ratings appear to be improving with voters, questions remain about who's the best candidate to challenge the governor from the Democrat camp. To discuss these issues and more, I'll speak with 90.7 political commentators Lou Fry and Dick Batchelor. Also later in the program, retired Lieutenant General Richard Zilmer talks about the connection between energy reform and security and explains Florida's potential for renewable energy. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio now by 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic State House representative, and he's the founder and president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Welcome, Dick.
It's great to be back.
And Lou Fry, of course, his colleague and friend Lou Fry, former Republican congressman. He's the founder of the Lou Fry Institute for Politics and Government at the University of Central Florida. Nice to see you back too, Lou.
Good of you to ask. You have a lot of courage.
I want to start with immigration reform. Lou, the last time you were here, and it was some time ago, you said that May was going to be do or die time for immigration reform in Washington. Are we any closer to getting some kind of immigration reform bill passing?
Well, yes.
How much closer? Okay.
Well, you're going to get a bill in the Senate passed, and it's going to be by a fairly large number in the 70s is my guess. And they did make a shot at trying to do it back in May, but it didn't have the impetus with it, and now they've sort of regrouped and come up with it. One of the problems I see for those who are looking at some real reform is the fact that people want border security. That, I think, Dick, is the one thing that everybody agrees on, whether it's another 20,000 agents and standing 250 feet from each other. But they do want that border security. So if you're not for immigration, your best deal is to vote for border security and that, take everything else out of the bill, and say, gee, we tried, now we've got border security, let's go on to something else.
Dick Batchelor, what are your thoughts on the immigration bill? If it makes it through the Senate, what are the chances of it getting shot down in the House?
Well, I think it makes it through the Senate, and there's some possibility in the House. You've got this group of eight, four Democrats, four Republicans working together, including people as disparate in most of their politics as Senator Schumer, you know, from New York, and Senator Rubio from Florida, trying to reach an agreement. And I think they'll get there. Now, this border surge, which was the infusion of dollars that Lou talked about going into proposed budget and really, you know, buying confidence that there will be security on the border, I think that goes a long way. It's hard to argue against that. So they're making some decisions and making some compromises. Schumer and others on the Democratic side are making compromises that I would never thought they would make. But they are making them because they do want to get a bill. The problem is the House is trying to sever the bill and pass parts of the bill. And that's when you run into trouble, too, because you can't pass omnibus legislation that way. So I think it passes in the Senate, puts pressure on the House to get it done. But I think the border surge is going to be the one thing that people can hold up and say, well, I wasn't in favor of it. Now, with the conditions set, I'm in favor of it.
Lou Fry, you've got your finger
up.
You want to say something?
Yeah, I do. And you can't talk about this without talking out the Florida Senator Marco Rubio. Mm-hmm. Because he has bet an awful lot of his political capital on this. And it's so far, I think he's ahead of the game. And I think what he needs is a relatively quick decision in the Senate to finish it off and to put it over to the House and try to get something through. If he gets it through, fine, a real bump for him. If he doesn't get it through and he's tried, he's still going to come out looking good. So if it doesn't pass, it isn't the end for Marco Rubio.
But is he going to come out looking good in the eyes of conservatives?
Well, he may not come out looking good in the eyes of conservatives no matter what he does. And I think when you're sitting up there, you got to figure out what do you believe in and how can you get the most of that.
Let me interject you. It is hard to earn political currency. It's very easy to lose it. Marco Rubio has been on the front of Time magazine and here and there and, you know, touted as a 2016 presidential candidate on the Republican side. But this bill is hurting him because the Tea Party and the conservative element of the Republican Party really elected him. And in recent polls, he's losing support there. And I don't say that to be negative about it, just politically honest about it. But he's really putting a lot on the line here. I mean, this whole immigration bill is a really almost a do or die for him. So that's why the whole border surge and border security is really, really important to him. But even as a last note, you've got his independent political action groups now running commercials attacking him, attacking Mitch McConnell, saying that all 11 million immigrants have committed a violation of the law in this country. It's still very negative and very, very nasty. So, I mean, I hope it bodes well for him, but I'm just simply saying on the very conservative side, the Tea Party side, he's not yet there with them. He might not be. I will say this. Congressman Alan West, the former congressman who was defeated last time, is now floating the idea that he might run against Marco Rubio to his right in the U.S. Senate.
That would be 2016.
How successful would Alan West be coming back, though, on the right of Rubio? I mean, doesn't it seem like Marco Rubio is able to sort of straddle that boundary between left and right and carve some sort of moderate path, although perhaps if you said he was a moderate, he might disagree. But would that still be...
you have to win the primary. And if the Tea Party and the Republicans and the conservative Republicans control the primary. But having said that, Rubio is a very strong name, is a household name. Alan West is a nutcase. So I think he...
And he's got a lot of time left. That's the other thing you got to look at. The election isn't next month.
Alan West has become a caricature of himself. So that's my personal opinion. So I think I think Rubio is still strong in the primary.
And we got Jeb Bush. Sure. Floating around in this whole, this is sort of like a murder mystery.
Well, let's talk about some more polling. A recent Quinnipiac poll puts Governor Rick Scott's approval rating the highest it's been since he took office, and that's at 43%. I mean, is this the time, do you think, for a big-name Democrat to announce now that Rick Scott seems to be gaining some traction? What do you think, Dick Batchelor?
Yeah, it is, and here's where we are, and we talked about this on the show before. I still think there is a chance that Bill Nelson will get in the race, our senior United States Senator. He's been a member of the House. He's been a congressman. He's been an astronaut. He's been insurance commissioner, been United States Senator. He's around 72 years old. Coming back to Florida and forgetting about your 99 colleagues in the Senate and 435 in the House, you're the governor, you get to make decisions. It has a lot of appeal. Having said that, he does need to make a decision soon, because Charlie Crist wants to get in, and Alex Sink is now saying she's rethinking it.
And Charlie's the floating around in this thing is the one I just saw recently. He was at a small county, and he did very well up there with the Democrats. I think it was over the West Coast somewhere. And he isn't giving up. He's out there working it. If John Morgan keeps the money coming, he's going to be a real comer. If I was Democrats and it came to that, if Nelson doesn't run, I'd go and put my money elsewhere.
Right, we don't have a real bench. And Charlie Crist, you know, he's going to obviously get into the race, but I still think he has to wait a bit and see what Bill Nelson's going to do. And Bill says he's not going to run, but he has to have like a absolutely not going to run before he makes that decision. But Charlie Crist will get in the race, and keep in mind, he doesn't really have to announce right now. You've got billboards, Morgan & Morgan billboards all over the state of Florida with Charlie Crist's picture on it. He's got great name recognition in the polls. So he is already ahead by several million dollars because he doesn't have to buy that media.
Mm-hmm. So he doesn't have to announce. What happens, though, if he decides not to run?
Then the Democratic Party, I guess our bench is maybe Alex Sink will get in the race. She still might get in now because she's kind of offended by Charlie Crist getting in. And she almost beat Scott last time. So I think now, you recall, her husband died about a year ago now, and she was kind of dissuaded from running. But I think now she's really focus on the possibility. And she seems to have more fire in the belly than she has last time.
That clock is ticking, though.
Absolutely.
And when you have a guy there who can write a check for $100 million or something like that, it really is ticking pretty loud. From the Republican side, you don't want to embarrass yourself. There are three cabinet officers out there, all of whom would like to be governor, all young, all talented, probably a lot easier to wait for 4 years and so forth and come out and do it then than jump right in it now. And so Republicans are sort of in a good position. They can sit back and look at it. If we get a lieutenant governor, then that lieutenant governor may become also in play. So it's a nice position to be in. Keep your mouth shut. Don't do much. Keep raising money and let the Democrats have a wonderful time like we have in the past.
If you leave aside the cash reserves that Governor Scott clearly has access to, do you get the sense, Lou Fry, that he's gaining some kind of political nous and becoming better at sort of playing that game?
I think that he, when he took the mantra that, you know, you can't run he wants to run a state like a business, you can't do that. State's not a business, it's differently. And it spent a whole year doing that and just going down, down, down in popularity. Somewhere along the line, he got some good staff people up there, people who knew Florida, knew how it works, and knew how to run it. And they started doing it, and they started building a new image of it. I mean, you take the vote on the health care. That was a vote to move him to the center of the Republican primary or the voters' primary, not just the Republican one, but of this election. He has the ability to do that. Sure, he's down under 40%, but he's been moving up. Hasn't made really any great mistakes. He's not a great orator, but he's trying and he's working hard. And he's got a lot of people who weren't for him and thought he was some neocon or something now who are at least for him. And my guess is if he keeps going like this and spending the money, I wouldn't be shocked to see towards the end of the year, the flip of next year, him to be close to 50%.
Recently, it was reported that Orange County Superintendent Barbara Jenkins was being considered for the lieutenant governor position. We didn't, of course, hear anything from the governor's office itself. But Dick Batchelor, you spoke to our reporter, Nicole Christen, here at 90.7 and said that this was an election strategy. What was he really hoping to accomplish with this, do you think?
They cut money out of K-12 education. The class, even though they've given an increase, it's still below the 2005 per student level. But he's getting out front. As I said before, there's an old saying in politics, if you're getting run out of town, get in front of the crowd so it looks like you're leading a parade. So he's trying to lead the education parade. And Barbara Jenkins, everyone who knows her loves her. She's a great superintendent. We're glad she's here. We hope she stays here. But politically, I don't see him choosing a female Democrat to be on his ticket. I think it's going to have to be an incumbent Republican female, incumbent
Hispanic,
legislator from South Florida.
Hispanic, if possible.
Right, Hispanic.
Yep. Because that's the area he needs to dig deep for votes.
Well, the bottom line is, and maybe Lou would agree or disagree, his likelihood of appointing a black female to the ticket, the likelihood of garnering any black votes is nil. But on the other hand, if you put a female Hispanic on your ticket, then you've got, of course, you've got different Hispanic constituencies, Cuban, Central American, Mexican, Puerto Ricans.
And Republicans have figured out women vote, you know? They're all of a sudden looking at, and they're looking at the Hispanic vote, because if they don't do well in those two areas, you can forget the election here, and you can forget the national election.
With a Hispanic female, it's a twofer for him politically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why Jeb Bush would look really good as a gubernatorial candidate.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm speaking with 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Dick Batchelor, a former Democratic State House representative. Lou Fry, a former Republican congressman. I'm Matthew Petty. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. You can also send us an email at intersection@wmfe.org. Dick Batchelor, I want to ask you now, Ali Sheets, a veteran of the Obama 2012 campaign, has been tapped by the Florida Democratic Party as their new data director. The use of this kind of targeting in Obama's data targeting in Obama's 2008 and 2012 campaign is largely credited for a successful bid. How important do you think is data in elections, and how important do you think it will be in the upcoming gubernatorial election, for example?
Very good. First of all, the Obama campaign, the first one around, got credit for really perfecting targeting and for Facebook and Twitter and aggregating that kind of data, which the retail market is perfected very, very well. Wall Street Journal last week had a compliment in their magazine really talking about data and how to do data management. Yesterday in the New York Times was a whole section, the whole cover story was about the team that you're alluding to and how they are now going to the private sector to tell them how to show them how to take this psychographic modeling and make it work well. The bottom line is this, it works extremely well. Get out to vote now. They had the criteria where they can say who you are, where you are, Democrat, Republican, household income, what magazines you subscribe to. They can really pinpoint where you lean on issues. The algorithms and the targeting, and it's extremely important. And I would suggest to you that is the difference between a win and a loss in the last campaign.
Well, Lou, what's your sense of how Republicans are doing in this era? Do you think they're lagging behind the Democrats a little bit?
Yeah. I think they are, but not that much behind, and they're aware that it's a problem. I think they're aware of what has been accomplished and everything. And what do they say that it's nice to have somebody look and copy what you do?
Let's move on now to talk about Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs. Now, she announced her run for re-election recently. She's gone essentially from running on a platform as an outsider in a kind of grassroots campaign in 2010 to working with the power elite, with big industries financing her 2014 election. Do you think this changes the way she runs the county if she's reelected?
No, I don't think it'll change her much. I think her record shows that she's a very decent, honest person. She's learned as she's gone along that It's not that easy to run a county, and you got to make sure you don't let the cell phones get involved in Texas and all these things she's gone through. But when you look back at her record and what she's done, she's worked hard. It hasn't been an easy economic time, but she has spent a lot of time trying to develop. Right now, she's very involved in, for instance, the simulation industry, which is the only high-tech stuff we have now that the CAPE is gone. So I think in a lot of ways, she's earned the respect of a lot of people. Now, it depends. Again, that could be a campaign that really the money pours into. Mm-hmm. I mean, that really is the only one locally and so forth that could gain a lot of attention, both through here and through the other parts of Florida.
Well, Lou Fried, do you foresee any strong, or do you see that there are any strong Democratic challenges in the wings there?
Well, Dick can tell you a lot more than I can about that, but there was a young lady who ran for the Congress and nearly got there.
Val Dibbings.
Val, who's looking, who's raising money now, and I know, the only thing I know is she's going to run for something. Mm-hmm. She is, and it could be this is the spot that she's going to pick. She'll also have pretty much, I think, a shot of being pushed in front by the Democratic Party because she's a very viable candidate and a very nice person.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, what kind of chances would you rate Val Dibbings if she decided to run against Teresa Jacobs?
It's hard, but if you're an incumbent county mayor, and you've got the advantage of the name recognition and you're raising money. What she has done, Teresa's done, she's gone out and tried to preempt any kind of competition. Having said that, Val Demings' numbers in the polls are very close to Teresa Jacobs. She's very popular. She's very well known, and her unfavorability is very, very low. So she's, from a polling standpoint, a public recognition standpoint, in a very enviable position to run and take on an incumbent. But you got to go raise the money.
Moving on to just one final thing, kind of quite local. The city of Orlando proposed an ordinance last week that was meant to reduce the amount of lawn fertilizer runoffs going into the city's lakes and rivers. Now, I know that both of you are interested in water quality. Dick Batchelor, do you think that this ordinance is too weak? Do you think it really packs enough punch, and does it do enough to protect local lakes and rivers?
It's too weak, and I speak as a former chairman of the Florida Environmental Regulation Commission and have some knowledge about these issues, and with the nitrogen runoff and a whole host of other toxic chemicals that are runoff, eventually watering your lawns, all those chemicals run off, they run into the public sewage system, and they end up in some lake someplace in a discharge area. I believe that the criteria have been higher. Unfortunately, the legislature passed a piece of legislation to allow cities and counties to have discharge levels below the state threshold, so it gives them some flexibility. Unfortunately, in my opinion, the city took the easy way out. They should have more stringent regulations on discharge from fertilizers. And the state of Florida, in my opinion, the State Department of Environmental Protection is very weak. There were proposed rules on discharge in the rivers and lakes. Unfortunately, the Environmental Regulation Commission pushed them back because they were too weak. Just hasn't been environmentally friendly as it was under previous administrations. Now, some Republicans work very closely on things like the Everglades cleanup and things like that.
Lake Apopka dredging, I did once, and then it's been done again.
But they've not been as strong as they need to be on environmental protection, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fried. Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic State House representative, and he heads the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Nice speaking with you, Dick.
Thank you. Thanks for having us back.
And also Lou Fry, a former Republican congressman and an attorney at Lowndes, Drostick, Doster, Cantor and Reed, and of course the founder of the Lou Fry Institute. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
Up ahead, retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General Richard Zilmer talks about the future of alternative energy in Florida. I'm joined in the studio now by retired Lieutenant General Richard Zilmer. Mr. Zilmer is speaking at a conference of Young Conservatives for Energy Reform. He was a Marine for 36 years, and now he's on the Military Advisory Board for the CNA, a think tank in Washington, D.C. Richard, thank you very much for joining me.
Matt, good morning. It's good to be here.
So tell me, what are the issues, as you see, regards to what needs to be done with energy reforms? What are the challenges and what are the threats? Because you're coming at this from a kind of military perspective, and you see energy as tied into basically the nation's security.
Absolutely, Matt. We've done four studies, one that looked at climate change and the impacts on national security, looked a little bit more directly at powering America's defense and the energy costs associated with that, powering America's economy. And then in 2011, we took a little bit closer look at maintaining freedom of maneuver in the transportation sector and the energy implications there. And most recently, just about a month ago, we released our latest work, which was done in collaboration with the European Union and RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute out of London, looking at some of the transatlantic issues related to energy, energy security, and climate change. So we continue to take on new topics as we go along on the order of about every other year. But what we're trying to do is add to the national debate, the national dialogue regarding national security and how it affects what we do. And, of course, as retired military officers, we bring a certain perspective to that discussion.
Now, you mentioned climate change. Clearly, climate change can be kind of a politically charged subject. Some people look at it and say, we're not really on board with that. How do you approach tackling something as serious as national security when clearly some people in the audience might not even think that climate change is necessarily something that they can prove or that is a real threat?
Yeah, and perhaps I did mention that CNA is a, we endeavor to remain apolitical, and we are a not-for-profit 501c3. Clearly, those discussion points invite a lot of interest, both for and against. But I think we would say that the preponderance of scientific evidence would suggest that there is warming, there is climate change. We're seeing the extremes in droughts. We're seeing ambient atmosphere temperature, ocean temperatures increasing. But what we don't get so much into why that's happening, although, again, the scientific analysis, which would say greenhouse gases contribute, significantly towards that. But our concern is the implications. What does that mean for the national security of the United States? What are the choices that the military is going to have to make in the upcoming years? With those extremes, the rising oceans, the droughts, the areas that are most affected, many of the developing nations, third world nations, that's where forces are going to be required to go in for humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, increasingly because of that. So that's the nexus of some of these developing nations being the most devastated, if you will, by some of that climate change.
We've seen countries close to Florida, Haiti, for example, affected by a pretty devastating earthquake. And if you talk about climate change and perhaps rising sea levels, then there are quite a few nations in the Caribbean where clearly they're quite low-lying. You would expect those to be affected by things like rising sea levels and more extreme weather. Do you think then that puts Florida in a position where this state particularly is going to see the effects of something like climate change and from a security perspective at a closer level?
Well, from a security perspective, some of those concerns about rising rising tides, rising seawater levels, many of the U.S. naval bases obviously are on the coast of the United States, and many of our bases are very, very near the coastal regions of the United States. So one of the concerns is how is our infrastructure affected in the future just within the United States alone? And, in fact, it could be affected by some of those phenomenons. With respect to Florida itself, I couldn't speak specifically for those issues that would most affect Florida. But again, as a general comment, we see that as a concern to our infrastructure throughout the United States, where our bases are here, as well as a number of bases that we have forward-based around the world.
Looking at Florida, what's your sense of what kind of resources we have? Clearly, there's an abundance of sunlight. There's a bit of wind as well, but it's kind of ungoverned at times, and we do get some pretty wild weather here. What kind of new forms or renewable forms of energy should Florida be focusing on?
Well, I think clearly, obviously, the renewables in Florida are the solar and the wind. I mean, this is and Florida's made some advances in terms of new forms of renewable energy in the form of wind. But these are, and I think in solar market, Florida has about the third most potential of all the states in the United States for solar. So Those two renewables, we think, represent a huge opportunity here for the state.
Florida is looking at prospecting for oil off the coast. Is that a bad idea, do you think?
No, it's not. It's not. And we've been very, very forward about what we see is a portfolio of energies that are going to include petroleum. We believe nuclear has its place to part to play. Coal is part of it. So it's not so much the example somebody gave me the other day is that, you know, all right, I'm not going to drive necessarily into a gas station. I might drive into an energy station where I get petroleum, I get fuel, I get ethanol, or I just plug my car in and recharge it for a period of time. So we've said, no, it's going to be a menu of a number of options. It's not going to be one single silver bullet petroleum that's going to be it. It's going to be a variety of energy sources. That's the future. That's the behavior change that we're going to have to learn to accept.
You talk about the nuclear having a part to play as well. What do you think the appetite is for nuclear power and perhaps developing new plants or investing in new plants or even revamping old plants here in the U.S.? I mean, looking at it from a global perspective, I get the sense that people might be a little bit leery of nuclear just because of what happened in Japan.
I think that's, you know, it's an option that's already out there. But I think where I would say, I think where the global community is looking at some of these other promising technologies that are out there. I don't think anybody's saying no to nuclear. I mean, it serves a very, very important role. But, I mean, we see, as I say, the geothermal, the wind, the solar. Those are technologies yet and capabilities that haven't been exhausted yet. We haven't, in my view, we haven't achieved all that we can there. So I think there's kind of in many cases probably wait and see. Let's look at these technologies first before we say no necessarily to any type, in this case, nuclear.
30% reduction in gas usage in the next 10 years, that's a pretty ambitious timeline. Can the United States do it?
Well, I think so, in particular where you talk about the transportation sector, where we're probably the most vulnerable. You know, you have the new CAFE standards that will go into effect gradually, incrementally by 2025, which will raise the corporate average to 54.5 miles to a gallon of gas. Europe is looking even higher than that. So those are, I mean, that's pending. That's going to happen. The industries, we've spoken with some of the automobile industries. They've come in and talked with us, and there are, you know, there are ways to get there. They're not necessarily going to be cheap. They are going to require some changes. But, yeah, we believe those efficiencies can be arrived at. You know, and I drive, and this is not a plug for Volkswagen, I drive my my 2012 Jetta TDI turbo diesel, you know, and I'm driving that thing on highways at 60, 65 miles an hour, getting 45 miles to a gallon of gas. You know, there are some answers out there, and we think those efficiencies can be reached, particularly with some of the CAFE standards that'll be applying soon.
I've been speaking with retired Lieutenant General Richard Zillmer. He's on the Military Advisory Board for the think tank in Washington, D.C. called CNA, and he's an expert in the link between energy and security. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection, where you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.